Everybody, welcome to Wesley. What an excellent afternoon. The weather's going to stay like this, I'm told, all afternoon. Couple of quick points, in case you didn't hear the notice earlier. If you can try and keep the tarmac road clear there, just so that the fire engines can whiz past if they have to. Dave's hopefully going to give opportunity for questions at the end. Unfortunately, because of the size of the venue, we can't do any kind of roving mic thing. So perhaps if you think of any questions during the session, you can think about coming up. We're going to have a microphone at the side that we can take questions from, so feel free to do that. So there's nothing else to say, really. If any of you were here yesterday for Dave Batstone's seminar, I can imagine you've come back for more because it was really excellent yesterday. Today, he's going to be speaking on the seven keys to living justly, so something really practical for us to hear today. Dave's quite busy in his life, as you can see from the programme. He's active as a journalist, university professor, social activist and business entrepreneur, so enough to keep anyone busy, I think. This is going to be an excellent talk. I'd like to give you a warm welcome for Dave Batstone, please.
Okay, thank you, those who came back. I decided to save all the important things I was going to say till today. So if you know, yesterday were a little bit disappointed, I think you have opportunity to be even more disappointed today. I want to mention in beginning that one of the groups that's on site that I'm been working with more recently and will be doing over the next year is called Stop the Traffic. Some of you heard Daniel Beddington last night refer to that group. Looked at stopthetraffic.org for their work in anti-slavery, something that affects 27 million people around the globe today. So stopthetraffic.org. I'm going to look at seven keys to living more justly. They're very practical, very pragmatic in that approach, and hopefully very personal. Most of the time when we talk about social justice, we talk in terms of statistics, we talk in terms of politics and policies. And I do want to link up some of those bigger picture issues to what we do with our own lives. So this is going to be a very kind of hands-on, nuts and bolts approach. So the seven keys for looking at a more just life for your family and for yourself have to do first with, and the first key I want to turn to, is very simply, fix yourself. The reason I say it that way is even though you might be tempted to think that if we could just get over ourselves, then we could act more justly in the world. I've been in enough Christian communities, social justice movements, political organizations, to know that when people don't fix themselves, they bring all kinds of baggage to the movement that they're a part of. They also control agendas in ways that bring out those issues that they have never fixed. So I want to walk a tightrope between fixing yourself and not obsessing with yourself. I want to look at that a little bit because fixing yourself has to do with placing yourself in a story. When I was younger, when I was just getting out of university, I thought the great freedom of life was that you could go and write your own story, write your own novel, write your own book. And that really is one of the gifts of God to us, is there's a certain free will that we have, a certain kind of capability, and particularly when we have the resources, material resources around us, to pursue dreams. The thing that I never reckoned on was that I didn't get to start writing my story on page one, chapter one. But rather, I jumped into writing the story at about maybe chapter 13. And one of the great tricks of my life, and I'm sure your lives as well, is how do you make those first 12 chapters make sense as you start writing your story? And I know people in their 70s and their 80s who never were able to figure out how to reconcile the first 12 chapters with the rest of their story. Some thought they would start with a clean slate on chapter 13, and they found that they couldn't get the story to move beyond those 12 chapters. It didn't make sense. It would be like somehow reading Grapes of Wrath and starting at chapter 14 with new characters, and you're figuring, well, what happened to the characters in the first 13 chapters? So one of the great maturity, spiritual and emotional challenges of life is to make your story reconciled. And if you don't make your story reconciled, then you're going to have a confused story. Maybe you don't like the family that you were raised in. Maybe you're really upset about the fact that you got raised in a Catholic or fundamentalist church. And you spent a lot of time in anger around that story, that part of the story. Maybe you're upset you grew up in Toledo, Ohio, or Manchester, Birmingham. That's your story. And until chapter 13, 14, and 15, and then on to the rest of the book, somehow deal with that early section that you had no hand in writing, but was delivered to you as the writer of your life, then you're going to be confused. The other part about fixing yourself is to be able then to start writing your story rather than living other people's stories. I said yesterday in our workshop that in America we celebrate the individual, and I am all for that movement, and I would just like to meet an individual. Instead, we're mostly like sheep. With protruding hips, we walk forward, following the line in front of us, and we don't write our own story. How is it that we're given the pen, but we don't have the freedom to take that gift that's been given to us? A lot of it has to do with fear and insecurity. We live our parents' story. We live our culture story. We live the story of what it means to be a success in the eyes of those around us. And what we do is we bury our own God-given passion. And we never get a chance to write. I mentioned that during my gap year, when I was in my early 20s, I went to Australia and lived in and worked in a urban mission community with homeless street kids. A young kid showed up one day with his social worker. Sometimes these kids would come to our house in Australia off the street, and sometimes they were brought by probation officers or social workers. There's a young man, 16 years old. His name was Ken. Ken came, and from the moment I met him, hate just raged through him. I mean, he had both his fists clenched when he met me, and he just talked with this sense of, you know, if he had half a chance and a little bit of permission, he would have punched you right in the face. So when I met Ken, I just started talking. I said, Ken, nice to have you here in our house. He said, are you a damn Yank? And I said, well, yes, I'm from the United States. I hate damn Yanks. I said, well, Ken, I'm sure we'll get along fine. Ken moved into the house, began to take part in our life. But from the very moment that he arrived, he was determined to make me hate him as much as he hated me. So when I went around the house and showed him the rules of the house, like 11 o'clock at night, the common room shuts down, the TV goes off, we all go into our rooms, the boys in the one room, the girls in the other, where you're going to sleep for the night. You can stay up in your bed all night awake, but all the lights go out, no common room. 11 o'clock comes the first night. Ken sitting on the sofa in front of the TV. I turned the TV off, said, okay, Ken, it's time to go. He said, I'm not moving, damn Yank. So rather than confront him, I just said, look, Ken, this place, we have common rules, and I'm not going to fight you over them. If you don't want to follow them, I'll get on the phone, I'll get your social worker and the police, they'll come and get you, and you go home tonight, or they'll take you somewhere else. But you're not going to be here. So he jumped up with his fist clenched, walked straight over to me where I was by the door, walked right by me, and walked out the front door. Stormed out. I thought I'd never see him again. Got everyone else settled down for the night. Went to sleep, and about 2 o'clock in the morning, I hear a pounding on the door. The front door of the house. Got up, went over, opened the door. And there's Ken, blood running down the knuckles on his hands all the way down to his elbow, both sides. And I said, Ken, what happened to you? He said, I went out of here. I went to the park down the street. I found a tree. I imagined it was your face, and I punched it as hard as I could both times. So after congratulating him on his powers of displacement of anger, I invited him back in the house. And Ken lived there for the next 6 weeks. But it was a funny thing. This is a part of a church, a Baptist church in the inner city of Melbourne. And as part of our ministry, as part of our work with homeless kids, we didn't require them, almost like an old rescue mission or Salvation Army type of operation, that you had to go to a church service in order to stay. We invited them to take part in our worship life and our community life, but if they chose not to, that was not a part of the package. Well, Ken came up to me the first Saturday before Sunday worship, Saturday before, and said, "Hey, damn Yank." By the way, in all the years I've known Ken, I never had another name except for Damn Yank. He said, "Hey, Damn Yank." I said, "Yes, Ken. I don't care what you say, I'm not going to church with you tomorrow." And so I explained to him, "Yeah, that's fine. That's not a part of the requirement of being here." All right. Fist clenched, walked away. The next Saturday, "Damn Yank, I don't care what you say, I'm not going to church with you tomorrow." I said, "Yeah, Ken, that's fine. You don't have to." On the third week, with equal conviction, equal anger and hate, Ken said, "Hey, Damn Yank, I don't care what you say, I'm going to church tomorrow with you." "All right, Ken. I leave at 9. You can go with me if you want." 9 o'clock the next day, there was Ken, ready to go to church. At this particular community, from time to time, we would have the baptism where you would have that little swimming pool or jacuzzi in the middle of the church floor. You pull up the floorboards and there you are. You dunk them down the old Baptist way. Well, we had a baptism that day, an adult baptism. And the way that the community did it, we'd all circle the baptismal font. And as the person came out of the water, walked up the steps, having committed their life in a new way to their faith, we would sing, "Welcome to the family." So this went on this particular Sunday. And as this is happening, the two sisters in the community are coming out. Everyone's singing, "Welcome to the family." Ken just burst out in tears. This tough guy with just so much rage boiling inside of him just bust out and start crying like a baby, just sobbing. So I pulled him aside and said, "Ken, what's going on? What's wrong?" He said, "You know, I just thought I could never have a family." He said, "You know, when I was 3 years old, my mother and father abandoned me in a hotel room in Melbourne. Police found me, took me to a foster home, and I don't know why, but they didn't like me and they got rid of me. So from that point forward, Ken was trying to make people hate him, reject him. He did everything possible. He went through 3 foster homes, then ended up going to juvenile hall prison for stealing a car when he was 13. Pentridge prison in Melbourne. Now he ended up at the doors of our community. And he had the sense he could write a different story. For all his life, he felt that his story was written to him, for him. And he had no hand in writing it. So he said, "How do I start a different kind of story?" That is what the community of believers should be. Inviting people to a different kind of story. Is whether we have the courage to feel that that story will bring us fulfillment, that that story will give us the kind of meaning and direction and purpose that the culture promises in so many other ways to give us. How do you fix yourself? Fixing yourself then means being able to move forward and get over yourself. Getting over yourself then is where your own passion meets the needs of the world, your vocation. I want to talk about that in a little bit. So, second key, I want to talk about your eating habits. What do you eat in the course of a day? That's the second key to justice. It doesn't have to be, you know, it doesn't have to be reading thick studies and books. Finding out about justice, living justly, begins at your table in the morning, at noon, and at night. What ends up on your table and how did it get there? Tracing it. And I really encourage you for this very simple discipline with your family or whoever you live with, is to just write down on a piece of paper every day all the things that ended up on the table. And then trace how they got there. Where were they produced? Who produced them? How much did it cost? And how much were the people who produced them get paid? And then, after you do that, day by day, try to change one product that becomes more just for those who produce it. I'm executive editor of a magazine called Sojourners, and we've recently taken on McDonald's in the United States. Not for just the fact they put out bad food, but more in terms of the justice of how they produce the food they do. We discovered in our alliance with Farm Workers Union in Florida that farmers who are picking, mostly Latino, Hispanic immigrants, who are picking tomatoes for McDonald's, are getting paid about 50 cents for every 32-pound basket, which means they have to pick 2 tons of tomatoes to actually make $50. Over 30 years, that payment has not gone up. They've been getting paid the same thing for 30 years. I don't know what the inflation rate's been, but I don't think it's been static. Not only that, the Farm Workers Union has been working with the Justice Department, our legal department in the United States federal government, and has uncovered 5 slavery rings. People who have been enslaved, trafficked into Florida, log into stopthetraffic.org, brought into Florida, and there made to force to work with their families to pick tomatoes. Taco Bell, which is another large fast food establishment in the United States, was caught doing the same thing. And last year, they came to an agreement with the Farm Workers Union about better pay, better conditions, and negotiated in good faith with them. And the boycotts that were brought against Taco Bell now ended. But McDonald's, rather than negotiate in good faith or rather, you know, have conversations, put out a PR campaign of studies where really workers are not in that bad a shape. And PR campaign suggesting that healthy food comes to you from McDonald's, trying to transcend or get over this. And so we're in the midst of this struggle right now. But if McDonald's ends up on your plate during the course of a week, you've got more problems than probably the Farm Workers Union at some level. But if it does on a consistent basis, then you need to look at that. What do you eat? And then after you really feel like you've got a handle on what you eat, what do you wear? Very simple things. First start with food, then go to clothes. Tracking that, being aware of how the food gets on the table, is incredibly important in a global economy. I was writing a book called Saving the Corporate Soul a couple years ago, and the phone rang. I picked up the phone, and it was AT&T, one of our largest phone companies, AT&T Wireless, saying that I was a very special customer. Not like most of you cretins out there, I was special. And because I was so special, they were going to give me a free phone for 6 months. Unlimited calling anywhere in the world. And then there was some kind of egregious relationship after that. It was one of my children. Or I can't remember what the actual contract was, but it looked good. And so I was really intrigued, and I said, well, you know, what would it entail? I mean, what's the relationship? How do I get into it? And they said, well, you know, by the way, by this stage, my daughter had done a good job lobbying me. She was 13. That life really isn't worth living without a cell phone. So, you know, I thought, wow, this is great. I could give her a cell phone for 6 months. I could figure out what kind of damage, how many extra jobs I had to get to pay for the bills and everything. So I said, well, how do I do it? I said, well, it's really simple. All we need from you is your credit card and your Social Security number, which is our employment number to pay taxes, your Social Security number. You know, it was one of those moments where I was kind of just sailing along listening to this pitch. Then I was like, wait a second. I don't know this guy. I could pick up the phone here in Cheltenham and say, look, I want to give you a luxury apartment in the Caribbean. All I need from you is your credit card number and your Social Security number. And then you give it to me, and then next thing you know, you're making payments on my condo in Aspen. So I said to him, well, look, I don't know who you are. Could you tell me? He said, well, I can't give you a phone number to call me back. I said, well, isn't there a number I could just guarantee is an AT&T number? No, I can't do that, sir. So I said, is there a supervisor there? And he comes on. He says, hello, sir, do you know you're a special AT&T customer? I thanked him once again for the wide recognition I had throughout AT&T. And then I said, you know, look, all I need from you is a telephone number that I could call you back because I'm interested in this deal you want to offer. I said, sorry, sir, I can't do that. But it's a very special deal. So when I said, well, okay, it looks like we can't do business today, what had become a kind of a rolling California accent suddenly turned into a very angry Indian man from Bangalore. Sir, we are promising to give you a free telephone. You must trust us with your social security number. And then it hit me what was going on. This poor chap was calling from India, trying to sell me telephone service in California, and I didn't trust him. I didn't know who he was. And so what I had to say to him was, you know, I'm sure you're doing a great job in Bangalore, but I can't do business when I don't even know who you are. Can't trust you. How much of these relationships are hidden underneath your food table every day, hidden underneath what we buy with our clothes, hidden underneath where we buy with our soccer balls, hidden underneath everything that we consume? How much of these relationships are hidden? And do you trust those relationships? Living justly is to follow and track them. That requires that you read more. I hate to tell you, you got to start reading a little bit. And read different stuff. The third key for living a more just life is to get educated, to read more. Every morning, what I do is I get the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. Very different politically, very different in terms of their view of financial markets. They give you different kinds of news. And in reading more, what we need to do, the last thing the world needs is a bunch of dumb activists. We need smart activists. People that think strategically and understand how things work, rather than knee-jerk kind of liberalism or knee-jerk conservatism. We need people who have values and then look at the best ideologies and strategies. They're not bought off by one political party or another. I don't know about you, but I'm sick and tired of someone telling me what I have to think because I'm a member of a political party or a church. We need free-thinking people. We need individuals. Read more. The fourth key. Well, I want to say something about this third key of reading more. And part of it requires turning off your TV. I had a great comment from a friend from Ireland yesterday here at the festival. He said, you know, I really liked what you had to say about consumerism yesterday, materialism. He said, yeah, I was thinking about advertising the other day. It's almost the exact opposite of therapy. Therapists tell you, there's nothing wrong with you. Pay me money and I'll tell you why. Advertisers say, you're really screwed up. Buy my product and you no longer will be. The flip side of the same coin, in a sense, that somehow you can fix yourself in a magical way, but you can't do it through consumerism. Read more. Figure out what's going on. The fourth one is what my friends who are Buddhists say, right livelihood. I love that term. In fact, I call my company Right Reality. Right livelihood means that after you have worked on yourself spiritually, you've begun to fix yourself, at some point you have to look at what you do day in and day out to make money. What right livelihood? To align your values with your work. And the beautiful thing about how my Buddhist friends do this is that they don't say, well, okay, quit your job and go do something else. But it's more of the sense of what we talked about yesterday. Begin slowly aligning your vocation to your career. In the job that you're in today, what's one small thing that you can do to align your vocation, your values and passion to your work? And maybe there will become a time when you need to then leave your job because that's impossible. But how do you bring your vocation, what I called yesterday, where your passion meets the needs of the world. How do you bring your vocation to bear on the needs of the world? It's right livelihood. And there's no formula for that. Very good friend of mine, John Sage, graduated from Harvard Business School, and he went to work in Seattle for Microsoft just when they were launching. John's one of the best marketing guys I know. He's a whiz. He knew how to market software. And if you know the Microsoft story, me being an Apple advocate and how they stole the beautiful design that they had, you know that they needed good marketers. But John was terribly successful. Then Paul Allen, who's the lesser known of the founders of Microsoft, recruited him to help start a new cable television channel. And so, you know, John's like one of these, you know, wonder kids that you see on the cover of Fortune or Forbes magazine. John went back to his 20th year reunion at Harvard Business School. And he's sitting by the pool, and he really wanted to see his friend, Chris Dernley. Chris had left Harvard Business School and had gone down to Costa Rica. He began projects for homeless kids on the streets of San Jose, Costa Rica, and then out in the rural areas. Literacy, Bible study, health care. They met at the 20-year reunion, and John pulled Chris aside and said, "Hey, let's go take our drinks by the side of the pool." And said, "Chris, you know what? I envy you a lot because it feels like you've done stuff with your life that you're just really, you have a sense of fulfillment about you." And Chris said, "You know, John, I have to admit, I'm kind of jealous of you. Is that, yeah, I went down to Costa Rica and did all these things, but my passion is to be an entrepreneur, and I feel like I haven't done that in 20 years, really. I've been a manager of these projects." And as they began to talk about what was really in their heart, what their passion was, they began to discover that even though both of them had, in what we would say, looking at them, very successful careers, both of them decided that they really had left behind their vocations. In their case, what they did is they both left their jobs and started Pura Vida Coffee. It's a coffee company that gives 100% of its profits to street kids around Latin America and around the world. John does great marketing, but he also brings it to bear on all the projects that they have. Chris does great projects in Latin America, and he turns it into marketing that they use in the coffee. You buy a pound of coffee from Pura Vida, and you're helping to fund good lives for kids who don't have them. Finding vocations doesn't always, it's not simple. There's not a formula. There's not a particular job for you. For some, it might mean moving forward on what you're doing, and others it might mean changing careers. But it's a right livelihood. Part of the thing that blocks us, as I mentioned yesterday, is security. So my advice for this key of living a right livelihood is get out of debt. If you're a student, don't get in debt. Pay off your debts, because debt becomes a spiritual issue, just like materialism is a spiritual issue. You start making choices about your livelihood that you'd rather not make, but you got to pay off your debts. It's very insidious, really, because when you start, you get out of school, you get a job, and you go, well, you need a good car to get to the job. And then you got to get an apartment, and the apartment feels small, and then you get a bigger apartment, and then, well, I'm going to buy a house because it's a good investment. You don't want to waste your money on rent. And then the car, you want a better car because you don't want to have that old rat trap you had. Before long, you start paying off the things that you get you to work, for the living of work, the debt that you've accrued. Keep out of debt. And if you're in debt, get out of it. It limits your spiritual options. Soon, decisions are made for you rather than you making decisions. Stories are written for you instead of you writing the story. Say, money is the root of all evil, particularly when you owe it to someone else. What about mortgages? Well, you know, I thank you for mentioning mortgages, because mortgages are a, a form of long-term debt that I should probably clarify, say short-term debt. Credit cards particularly. Credit cards are, and I don't know how they work in Britain, that they are incredibly dangerous in the United States. Because what the credit card companies do is that they lure you in to a lower rate. And then once you get into debt, they start raising the interest progressively. A very dear friend of mine got into this credit card situation where she got into the debt at 12% on her credit card, and soon she was paying 28%. She called up and said, could you stop raising the interest rate? I'm trying to pay you back, but I find that I keep paying the interest. And I can't get to the actual amount I owe you. And they said, look, we know you're not going to pay it back anyway, so we're just trying to squeeze you as much as we can before you go into debt and go into bankruptcy. I could not believe it. And in fact, in my investigation for my book, Saving the Corporate Soul, one of the largest credit card companies in the world actually had this strategy. We can never get back all the debt that Americans have, so let's get as much as we can out of them in the short term. But that puts the cramp on you. That becomes a spiritual issue. We need to talk about it in churches. We need to talk about it in churches as a real challenge to our livelihood. The fifth key for right livelihood, living justly, the fifth key then, is democratize capital. Democratize capital. And I say that because so many of my leftist or liberal friends, I don't think really understand how economy work oftentimes. They want to bring justice to people. And they say, so anything that has to do with capital or capitalism is evil. Meanwhile, the people who live in India and Asia and Africa and live under incredible burdens of debt and poverty have to face capital every single day as a life or death issue. There are no other alternatives out there right now. How do you help people who are struggling to make a livelihood? So not even right livelihood, but survivable livelihood. How do you democratize capital in a way? How do you give access to capital? How do you help to build markets in communities that don't have markets? How do you use the resources that we have in order to provide a platform for people to build a just lifestyle? We need to get beyond the old development model of doing things for people. It's as paternalistic in a way as the things that get them into debt in the first place, so that we do things for them rather than empower them. Yesterday, Tom Hewitt talked about what's going on in Durban in his project. I was just in South Africa with him. How they've turned over their project to the street kids. At first they got them off the streets and then said, okay, what are the tools we can give you that you can build your own platform going forward? Right Reality, my company, has a project in Peru where we're creating small loans for kids, 15, 16 years old, and said, you can be your own business owner. They start to create their own businesses, then we help them create a market. How do you give people tools for their own justice? Be suspicious when someone says, I'm going to give justice to you. Because when someone gives justice to you, it's not your justice. The poor are manipulated. The poor are used. The poor become a marketing, a promotion tool to raise funds. We need to rethink how we do development work. I worked in development work in Latin America for over 2 decades. How do we rethink it that we give tools that we empower rather than do things for people? How do we democratize capital? Buying fair trade is a wonderful way of doing that. With coffee, sugar, you name it, chocolate. That's democratizing capital. What are ways and very pragmatic, practical ways that you and your church or your organizations can democratize it? How can you give other people access to resources? That's a real issue. Because then when you democratize capital, you start to democratize political structures. You start democratizing local relationships. How do you do that? One way that my organization is doing right now is working with freed slaves who've been in rice mills in India or brothels in Cambodia. They've been forced to pick tomatoes for McDonald's, helping them start their own business and then creating markets, export markets. So one example is a woman, Annie Dieselberg in Thailand, who in Bangkok was helping girls get out of the brothels, but she needed an alternative. If they're going to get out of the brothels, you're going to say, you need to leave the brothel, escape. They've been kidnapped oftentimes, and they've been in this brothel. It's their only livelihood, and say, you just need to leave. And oftentimes the girls will say, and do what? Where am I going to go? How am I going to survive? Well, Annie heard the story so many times, she started to create a jewelry business, helping them design jewelry for U.S. and European market. And she's turned that over to them. There's 35 women who run this jewelry store with her. They're jewelry manufacturing. She's trying to, in a just way, democratize capital. So when we talk about democratizing with elections, let's talk about democratizing with capital, giving people the tools and resources to build their own life. The sixth key, create new rituals for your family, for the people you hang out with. What are new rituals? Well, I'll tell you one. I'll tell you the things we try and do in our family in California. I have four kids, 9, 11, 13, and 15. The off year was just fantastic for us. 9, 11, 13, 15. And what we would do from the time they were very young is that we wanted them to get a sense of spiritual livelihood, a sense of spiritual memory, a sense of we have rituals that don't necessarily go on with the rituals of the culture. You want to see the rituals of the culture? I have a great idea for you. Take like a TiVo, a tape of television shows over 12 hours. Erase all the programming. Just watch the commercials. You know, usually you just watch the programming and erase the commercials. Just watch the commercials. You'll get a sense of the angst and anxiety that advertisers see in us and want to tap into us and try to hook us with. It's a story. And it's almost like a stream that moves this way. And to fight it, you have to really fight your way upstream. So in our family, we try to build some rituals. One is we refused to practice Christmas the way that our culture told us that Christmas was to be celebrated. It seems small, but they're small rituals. It was like just an endless kind of gift list. And what do you want for Christmas? And I didn't get what I wanted. And we saw this with other families. We said, we don't want to go that direction. So, on the other hand, young children growing up, we're going to say, hey, look, we're not going to have gifts. Instead, we're going to have coal for Christmas. You know? Or, you know, or we're gonna go and work in India. Well, that's not going to work with young kids either. So what we've done over the years is that we've taken any money we might use towards all these gifts, and we've done something together as a family. We call it our family together time. Isn't that what Christmas is, celebrating a newborn baby who comes into a people's life and transforms that life, and what that new birth might mean in the family? And so we've started celebrating. We go different places. And as they're older now, they have a say in where we go. And as they're older now, we start to do things like this year we're going to go to Habitat for Humanity and build homes together as a family. They wouldn't have worked when they were eight. Then we'd go to the beach all together. But it's seeing that there is alternative rituals. They now look at Christmas as a time of family spending together doing something, not what gifts they'll get or what gifts they will compare themselves with all the other kids at school. Easter, how do you celebrate Easter? We have a spring ritual for that that goes outside of the culture. Television. We don't watch TV in our house. It's really hard, countercultural. But their stories are being written for them. They're written for me. I don't want that little box in my room 4 hours a day telling us what our story should be. I tell you, it's insidious. It really is. What are the rituals? Eating a dinner together at least once a day. If at all possible, maybe 5 times a week. I don't know what it's like in the UK, but a small minority of families actually have a meal together once a day in America. Everyone's too busy. It's fascinating all the studies that have been done that show the impact for those families that have at least one meal together in terms of the social behavior at schools, in education, a whole range of factors. The impact is having a meal together. So when the food's done, the kids want to rush off. I say, hey, kids, look, dinner is more than a meal. Think justly about the rituals you create in your family. It's very important as a parent that you become more deliberate. You just don't raise your kids and send them off to school and let them get socialized. It has to be very intentional. I might sound like some kind of right-wing homeschooled nut or something. But really, we have to be more intentional about how we raise our children. What values that we as families embody and that they then carry out to school and they compare it with other families. You know, sometimes my kids will come home and say, tell me again why we don't get a bunch of gifts for Christmas. Why do I have to be home for dinner again tonight? And then explain, well, you know what? This is really what it means to be in this family right now. It's really important. They said, well, when I'm a parent, I'm not going to do that. And I'll say, well, that's great. You'll have your chance. It's the wonderful thing. You'll get to write your story one day. Right now, together, we're writing it and kind of, you know, these are your 12 chapters. The final key I want to turn to is live generously. Live generously. And there's a wonderful website that came out of Greenbelt called generous.co.uk. And I highly recommend that you go there just to see practical ideas that people who go to Greenbelt and leave, what they do on a day-by-day basis to be generous. So how do you live generously rather than live unjustly? Things like how do you use energy-saving light bulbs? Selling your cars. Martin Rowe here at Greenbelt was one of the founders of Generous. They sold both their cars. Now when they go to Greenbelt and they need a car, they rent one for the weekend. When they go on a trip, they rent a car or hire one. They got rid of their cars. They saw that was being generous to the planet. They invited a dinner guest over every couple of weeks. They put this on the website, and then someone else says, oh, I want to do that too. So now you have two people. Then you have a third person. And you start to see the accumulation or the aggregation of generous activities. And what's the impact if you get now 1,000 people who are signed up? What happens if in another year there's 10,000 people who are doing generous things? What's the collective and aggregate impact of just simple things that we do in our own families, in our own homes? I encourage you to go to generous.co.uk. This is a great company out of the United States, Portland, called Hannah Anderson Clothes. And it started as a generous company. It decided that kids didn't have very good clothing, cotton clothing. This woman, Gun Anderson from Sweden, decided to create this company in the States. And so she was so confident of the importance of this clothing that she said, I'm going to sell the clothing, and if you buy a piece of my clothing and turn it back in, I'll give you 20% off on your next purchase, and I'll take this clothing and I'll give it to a child in a homeless shelter in Portland. Because the clothing is going to outlast the life of your child. It's also going to outlast the life of the children who use it in Portland. This became the ethos of the company. It was a generous company. And Hannah Anderson Clothes grew into an amazing company where you bought a piece of clothing because you felt good about the fact that after you used it, it was going to be good for your child. It was going to be good for another child. Build generous companies. Hannah Anderson Clothing. Pura Vida Coffee. Build generous law practice. Build generous medical practices. Build generous bike shops. Build generous auto repair shops. What does it mean to be generous? Bring your vocation into your career. Bring justice into your table. Bring caring relationships and just relationships into your family life. Don't go along with the story of the culture. Write your own. Thank you very much.
David, thanks very much for what you said. The thing about TV, I take the challenge personally. In the right sort of way, personally, I'm not hurt by what you said. My worry is, though, that an awful lot of the people that I know in Christian circles who don't watch TV are the very Christians who are out of touch with culture. And they're hopeless at evangelism. So I don't know if we wanted to respond to that.
Yeah, thank you. To clarify that is, I'm not suggesting that maybe you turn your families into the Amish. And, you know, no electronics and no TV and kind of remove. It's rather having a sense of control or a sense of intentionality, be a better word, around the kind of media influences that you bring into the home. Now, obviously, you know, I don't put a little boxes around my kids' ears so they hear nothing else at a friend's house or at school. But in our own house, we do have a television that's not hooked up to any kind of reception, and we will watch maybe a tape that someone says, man, this BBC production on X, you should watch. We watch it. Or good movies that we think are worth watching, we watch them. So it's not as if they are completely removed from pop culture, but rather that we have more intentionality about what they watch, so that someone just doesn't turn on the TV and just watches hours. Also, of course, we're limiting how much. We're not fighting the daily battle. Come on, why can't I watch TV now? Can I watch it now? How about, you've been a parent, you know that battle. We just don't fight that. Now our kids, I mean, they're 15, 13, 11, and 9. They don't say, you know, they don't even, they do other stuff. It's not a battle. It never became an issue. You know, it comes up once or twice. You say, yeah, we don't do that. Oh. They always hearing that. They always hate to hear that. We don't do that. And they go, oh. And they know, well, that's dad-eccentric and mom's-eccentric kind of thing. But when I get older, I'm not going to do this to my kids. I accept that they may not.
Hi there. There's just one thing that you said that I think it's good, but there's maybe a point beyond it. You talk a lot about democratizing capital and buying fair trade and having fair trade, generous companies. But the problem is sometimes that a lot of the large corporations now, I mean, you mentioned McDonald's, are starting to, you know, do the minimum fair tradeness that they can get away with to get people in, to get the moral consumer in. And I think there is a sense that, yeah, you can buy, by all means, if you're buying things, buy ethically produced goods. But there's times when you need to have a spirit of poverty as well and just say, I'm not going to buy that. Yeah. I don't need my second coffee of the day from Starbucks. I don't need, you know, even if it is fair trade coffee, I don't, you know, just don't need that stuff. I don't need to go out with money and my credit card and my Switch card every day, you know?
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, materialism, really, we talked more about it yesterday. Is there just a real challenge to us? Because it's things that we think we need, then they drive us in terms of decisions and opportunities that, I mean, it's a spiritual issue. So materialism certainly is an issue. Also, I'd say democratizing capital is not only about buying fair trade, as you suggest. I say it's also buying locally, buying from your local shops, buying from local producers, buying from much more strategic. It's not like I have anything wrong with, I'm sure the people who created Walmart are wonderful people. But the more that you aggregate capital in single hands, it does not lead to justice. We know that. It doesn't lead to more democratic social structures. We know that. And so the reason that we democratize capital is because we distribute opportunity and power. And consumerism, you're right, in a sense, with the way we consume, we vote every day about the kind of power that we're allowing to exist in the world with the ways we consume. It's a vote. It's like ticking the ballot box every day.
Yeah, Dave. George Monbiot, the Guardian columnist, environmental campaigner, activist of all sorts, in a recent book called The Age of Consent, he talks about this idea of a global capitalist system, combination of governments, International Monetary Fund, World Bank, World Trade Organization, this kind of stuff. And his view over this area of personal activism is that, well, to be provocative, it's a waste of time. That, you know, well-intentioned liberals can luxuriate in buying fair trade, this, that, and the other, doing, you know, all the things that you've described. But if you imagine that it's going to make the slightest difference to the wickedness of the global structures which dominate the world, dream on. And he's not saying don't do it, but he's saying you'd be much more effective lying down in front of traffic, chaining yourself to railings, getting involved in non-violent protest, in direct action, in all of that stuff. And in fact, his theory is that the only way forward is a mass rebellion on the part of the poor countries, simultaneous debt default, the kind of thing that Venezuela is doing at the moment, that power will never be given up by the powerful, you know, and that the powerful structures are very happy for well-intentioned liberals to have 5% of product being fair trade, etc. And I wondered if you care to respond to that.
No, that's very important. It's, you know what? Because really, he's absolutely right. If the only thing we do is, well, we buy a cup of fair trade coffee every day, we use a little less water in our showers at night, we do these little things. If that's all we do, he's absolutely right. Nothing will change, and we are wasting our time. But really what these individual personal things are preparing, okay, soldiers for a battle, preparing people, equipping them, and in a sense, giving us tools to better understand how the world works. When I understand what's on my table, I understand now more about trade. I understand about the injustice that gets perpetuated by the IMF. And then I try to bring to bear policy changes. Now, the wonderful thing right now about this slave work I'm doing, yes, I can help kids who are taken out of slavery. Yes, we can help rescue people and try and do prevention for young women who are trafficked. But until we actually change legal systems that allow companies and governments to profit off of young girls, nothing will change. How do we get a mass of people to do that? Start living justly and then turn that into political action. The two have to be linked. But my experience is that people do not get involved politically unless they're involved individually. If they personally don't experience it, then they don't turn it into voting and then advocacy and then changing laws. And it has to be linked. But to build a movement, and we saw this with the abolitionist movement 200 years ago, individuals making choices about their personal lives that they will then link to their political lives. And the two need to go together. But let's not fool ourselves that second cup of coffee is somehow going to change the world alone. But change starts here. It's a contradiction. You folks are wonderful. Thank you very much.